Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, we heard from author Jonathan Rose recently. He was talking about the early signs of urban life in human society and the origins of the American city. We touched a bit on the suburbs, but you know what? We really didn't go into it. But tonight we thought we would talk more about the history of suburban development here in Chicago and how it may have been the genesis of urban sprawl as our country knows it. My guest tonight is Elaine Lewinnick. She's the author of The Working Man's Reward, Chicago's Early Suburbs and the Roots of American Sprawl. In the book, Elaine looks at the forces at play that created suburban sprawl, but also what it meant to be chasing the quote-unquote American dream. Elaine Lewinnick is a professor of American Studies at California State University, Fullerton, and she joins me tonight. Elaine, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I'm fascinated by the marketing aspects of the American dream. We've heard about this American dream, this picket fence, this the idea that you own this suburban home, and that's really what we're at. But reading your book, I mean, it really comes in this roots of product, of business, of marketing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, first of all, it wasn't an American dream. It's an immigrant dream. At the turn of the century, in every city that we have studied, native-born Americans wanted to rent and not own. It was mostly European immigrants who brought this yearning for home ownership. And in Chicago, which held itself up as a model city, people were critical of it. They called it the peasant yearning for land. They thought it wasn't a good thing to sacrifice other things like your kids' schooling to pay for your home. But that idea that home ownership brings a certain kind of respectability and a certain kind of citizenship.
Inclusivity, not, too.
Yes, yeah. Right. But it's not an eternal American dream. Very early America, people rented, people boarded, even when they had a lot of space. They lived just on the southern tip of Manhattan. They lived just around the fort that was early Chicago. They did not sprawl out into single-family home ownership. And they didn't even live in what we think of as nuclear families. They had apprentices and boarders and grandmothers and aunts and house guests who never left. And the idea that you would live in a house with just the nuclear family and that it would be a house you want to own, that came fairly late in America. It comes after industrialization.
And that and really was a marketing push, too, to sell mortgages and houses and the business of real estate.
Yeah. It was marketing the land, too. The early developers of Chicago had to market that you want to buy land here. And people didn't. It was swampy. It smelled of garlic, you know. They had to make up the idea that this is going to be a city. And it's a city that you want to invest in because someone else is going to want to buy it from you. And that whole invention of ideas of property values, it happened here. And it happened in amazing ways. If land that costs $1 an acre in 1830, you could sell for $80 in 1836. You could make so much profit, although then it was only worth 50 cents in 1842. And so there were these real estate booms and busts that make things it's weird precursors to today, you know, and we've all seen in the last 10 years what happens when the real estate market fails and how that has ripple effects through so much else. The real estate market created Chicago, and that dream of homeownership for everybody was pushed in Chicago from the top down, but also from the bottom up, from those immigrants.
Let's talk about late 19th century. I mean, right before the Chicago fire, I mean, this was a town that was on the make. I mean, this was everybody. I mean, it was almost growing too much, as we know. But this was the sort of model of American cities. This was a place that people wanted to be. But there wasn't as much suburban sprawl at that point. Right now, before the fire, it was just really concentrated, dense city.
There was just the little bits, like Riverside had been built in 1869, I think it was. So, you know, a couple
just started,
years before the fire,
right.
And which we think of now as this model planned suburb. But even it actually went bankrupt in the 1890s. It wasn't a model that people embraced. That suburb as a residential only space, as an elite space, as a space that's marked as white only, that was not Chicago's model at all. Chicago had a different kind of sprawl. Because Chicago was diverse, and it's a diversity we have trouble seeing now, but it was diverse because there were Irish, there were German, there were Polish, there were Jewish. That was seen as diversity back then. They were seen as not quite white, and in academia we call them probationary white. Is this something everybody knows?
I don't know.
This is like, it was news to me when I was in grad school, but I don't know how much what we professors now take for granted. Everybody else knows. But yeah, the whiteness is a coalition. It's a group, and different people get allowed into that coalition of whiteness at different times. In the 19th century, what we now think of as ethnic Europeans were not fully permitted into that coalition. Enough, they were allowed to immigrate because the immigration laws allow free white persons. And so Europeans could come when Samoans couldn't, but not enough that they were allowed to have any job or live anywhere. Well,
we saw this a lot with immigrant populations from Germany, Italy, places like that, where they would come in droves, but the jobs were labor-intensive jobs. They were construction jobs. They were not necessarily automatically let into the city in this kind of way that they do now.
And they're the ones who built Chicago. They brought with them this dream of homeownership, and they helped build Chicago. And they, at the moment of the fire, they had homes mostly on the north side. The part that burnt the most was Irish and German. And they were blamed for the fire, you know, the whole myth of this
cow,
is O'Leary's which is a myth, by the way. But it was a way of blaming the Irish female person who was milking at the wrong time of day, because you shouldn't even need to have a lamp when you're milking your cow. They were blamed for being not quite proper people. And one of the ways they wanted to use homeownership was to assert their respectability and their domesticity. Yeah. They're not foreigners. And they would compete, you know, like the Slovaks claim they owned more homes than the Czechs because they thought it made them look better. You know, the ethnic press of Chicago is really, really fascinating.
Well, I mean, I also think that obviously the roots in this being a melting pot, the idea of the city of neighborhoods, and you see that in what we're talking about. Well, when the fire happened, one of the things I thought was interesting in the book was sociologically as well, the fact that everybody was stranded.
Yes. So at the moment of the fire, it's great for urban historians because everybody was talking about the structure of the city. And part of the panic of the fire was that without the built environment, you couldn't tell who was rich and who was poor. And there was this intermingling of classes, of genders, and it seemed dangerous to people. Immediately after the fire, the aldermen built barracks to house the homeless, which makes good sense. But then the elite philanthropists of the city took over administering the aid that had been donated to Chicago. And those native-born elites did not want the barracks. They found them very, very dangerous. And so they tore down the barracks. It was winter. The fire happened in October. It was a cold winter. You had more than 8,000 people who needed some place to live. And instead of letting them stay in the barracks, they tore down those barracks to erect single-family homes. And they felt that single-family homes were healthier physically because germs can't spread as well, but healthier morally too. They had this idea that if you can see who's going in the door, you know who's sleeping with whom. That they really felt that apartment living is this dangerous, promiscuous French thing, and that we don't want it in Chicago. Some of the workers' leaders were also saying, those elites, they want to get us in houses, they want to tie us to the land the way the peasants were, they want to have us paying mortgages so we can't go on strike, so we lose some of our freedom, that it was this sort of conspiracy. And there are ways you can see this after the fire, that the elites really wanted people into houses.
Right.
But the working class people, they wanted houses of their own. And so they accepted these houses, and they were tiny houses that the relief fund would help you build. They accepted these houses, but they wanted to build them close to where they worked. And so after the fire, it's much less known than the fire itself, but in January of 1872, the working class immigrants from the north side stormed City Hall because they were mad at what we would now call zoning rules. But back then, they were new fire safe rules.
Right, the rules that you had to abide to build a house. And a lot of the German and Irish were like, I want to build a house how I want to build a house. And they were pretty restrictive because they just went through a huge fire, right?
The rules were classist, though. They were rules that prohibited building with wood. You had to build with brick, and brick is a lot more expensive than wood. But you could still build a fancy elite mansard roof that is actually incredibly flammable. So they weren't exactly rules to protect from fire. They were rules to protect from poorhouses, and the poorhouses that were seen as more dangerous fire hazards.
Interesting.
And so the rules were justified as we're protecting from fire, but the workers said, no, those rules are ridiculous, and if you make us build with brick, we can't actually build. And we, poor people, we didn't have the fire insurance that the rich people had. All we have is the fact that we have this little plot of land we owned, and if we can't build on it, we have to sell it for nothing. We have to move far outside of the city limits to build the cheap houses that are all we can build. They felt incredibly threatened, and they stormed City Hall in a way that was very threatening to City Hall people. They shut down City Hall. The English language press accused the immigrants of trashing the place. The immigrants said that all they did was march in to explain their point of view. But it was this amazing moment when housing that matters to me, a housing historian, also clearly mattered to the people on the ground.
We're talking with author Elaine Luenick. The book is called The Working Man's Reward, Chicago's Early Suburbs and the Roots of American Sprawl. She's a professor of American Studies and a housing historian, California State University, Fullerton. It's interesting because that, as you said, I mean, the idea being that those restrictive housing zones and rules really push people further out and started a pattern of early closer suburbs.
Yes.
Let's pick up there. Once that started to be built out, when did it really take off? When the suburban experience for Chicagoland, quote unquote, which is interesting, we'll get that.
Yes.
Became as it is now.
Well, so we have to actually back up and try to define suburbs, because there are myths that suburbs are all the same, that they are the boring and the bland place with the desperate housewives and everybody's white. And the more you look at Chicago, anyone from Chicago could tell you that's not true for Chicago. The suburbs are diverse, and they're diverse in interesting ways. There's elite suburbs and there's working class suburbs. And even you take an elite suburb like Evanston, it wasn't built as residential retreat, it was built around the university. And it's not only white, it has a significant African American population. And every suburb you look at is different and mm-hmm. interesting. So Chicago has suburbs, and it has some of those domestic suburbs, bedroom community suburbs, middle-class suburbs, but it also has working-class suburbs.
But, I mean, major areas like New York or L.A. or other places like that, is it similar patterns? I mean, you see suburban life the same way that you do in Chicago?
When you're talking about L.A., you have to tell everybody Watts is a suburb. Compton is a suburb. It's got single-family home ownership. It's black home ownership and more Latino home ownership, but it's still suburban outside the central city. So each time you have to explain to people that the myth of suburb doesn't actually work mm-hmm. when you look on the ground at any particular space. And the fact that we have this myth that is contradicted by life on the ground is really interesting.
Where's the myth come from?
I think it comes from marketing. You know, because suburbs are an idea and they're also an investment. So people buy their houses because they're hoping at some point to resell it. You're hoping to make a profit from it. And so you have to imagine that there's some neutral buyer out there who's going to want what you want. So this whole thing gets marketed. But I grew up in a suburb of Boston that is, it's a famous suburb too. Mine was not a single family home. After my parents divorced, my mom took in boarders, and so did half our neighbors. We didn't talk about it, though. I'm sorry, I'm not speaking so clearly, we weren't supposed to tell our neighbors that we took in boarders because we didn't have all the proper permits for renting out the third floor to our tenants. And my sister, who is much more attuned to issues of prestige than I am, told me that it doesn't make us look good that we rent our third floor. So we're just not going to mention it. And I think, though, that experience of we just don't mention it, but we know the neighbors across the house, the way are they have their adult kids
yeah, that's
still
a
living
shared
with them,
experience, of course.
All sorts of people, and even if it is more prestigious, those people have their au pair living with them. It's not always a single family
in
one place.
For you as a historian, what was it about Chicago and the early suburbs of Chicago? I mean, you talk about it, and that's what I'm getting at with New York and L.A. And the difference. What was it about this experience that you latched onto that said, this is the beginning of what we know as the suburbs in this country?
Chicago's so fascinating because it grew so quickly. It doubled in size almost every decade of the 19th century. And can you imagine living in a city that doubles in size and then 10 years later doubles again in size? So it's this city that was growing very self-consciously and promoting itself very self-consciously. And I didn't know till I researched this book that Chicago got called the Windy City not because of the wind off the lake,
of course, yeah.
but because of its boasting.
Right.
It's the bragging city. And I love that about Chicago, that it is this very documented city. Richard Wright, the great African-American writer, called it the known city. Mm-hmm. It's this city that was growing quickly and selling itself. It's famous for its boosters, and it's also famous for its social workers, its sociologists, all of these people who were watching Chicago. And there is such great turn-of-the-century literature about Chicago. And so to understand what a suburb looks like, you can look at Chicago and see it growing at the same time as the idea of suburbs. And you can see the marketing, because Chicago has these incredible archives. So you can see those early ads. And then you can also see not just the marketing, but the social workers who were going door to door and documenting what was really happening in these places that were putatively suburbs.
I mean, a big part of your book is dedicated to the relationship, the race relations in this area, the race riots of 1919. You talk about the mortgages of white. We know that in Chicago, it's been very well documented, this white flight, this concept of people leaving different areas for the suburbs because, you know, they wanted to live around white people. They want to be around African Americans in Chicago. That's the story that's been told, redlining, everything in between. But let's go back, because that's the one thing Jonathan Rose talked about as well, was this idea of the mortgages and the concepts of almost the mortgage industry creating suburbs because they offered mortgages to certain people to say, this is a good mortgage for you. Come on out.
So suburbs come earlier. You know, the mortgage industry is actually after the 1930s and after the 1950s. And I'm interested in the earlier roots of it. And the earlier suburbs of Chicago, it's not white flight. These people didn't identify as white. They were identifying as Polish or German or Irish or all sorts of other things. The early suburbs of Chicago came for a couple overlapping reasons. And one of them was factories. Because for most factories, you need horizontal space. There are some businesses like journalism where you're still in downtown Chicago. We're talking right now from downtown Chicago. You can do it in a vertical space in these skyscrapers. But if you're doing something like meatpacking, which helped invent the assembly line in America, you need horizontal space. And that is expensive if you're in the central city. So things like meatpacking moved out of the city quite early, partly because they were inventing the assembly line and partly, too, because they wanted to avoid city rules about disposing of all the gross byproducts. So they moved out early to a place outside the city that was called then the Town of Lake. It even had a name in Lithuanian. It was Town Lakis. I don't actually speak Lithuanian, so I might be bungling that. But I love that it was called Town Lakis. And then Chicago, because it was trying very, very hard to boost itself, Chicago annexed a lot of its outlying areas because they really wanted to win the census of 1890. They wanted to be the fastest growing city. And so they took in all sorts of things that weren't really considered city at the time. So Lake was absorbed into Chicago, along with Andersonville on the north side and all sorts of things. But Town of
Lake, we know as neighborhoods now were considered like early suburbs. But they were, go ahead.
Yeah, and they still have their own names. You know, although Town of Lake has lost its name, we now think of it as Back of the Yards. This is what drew me into the project, is the ad that you see on the cover, is this ad repeated in so many suburban histories that's by this Chicago developer named Samuel Eberle Gross, who I adore, partly because he named places after himself. He really thought Grossdale and Grossville and Gross Ave were great names. They've all changed their names now. But he built all sorts of interesting suburbs, and he had some great marketing. So this one ad of his is called The Working Man's Reward, and it shows an angel descending in a burst of light to a working man who's sitting in a desolate landscape. And the angel is presenting him with this suburban pastoral house. And this ad is used in a lot of suburban histories to explain this is why America suburbanized. It's these Christian ideas of morality that come with the home. It's this pastoral ideal. And the ad on the top says only $100 down, easy terms. You know, it's also these financing terms that Chicago developed early on in the 1830s. They called it canal terms because nobody had any cash, but they all wanted to buy land before the canal was built and the land went up in value. So this ad is used all the time. But when you actually look at the ad, one of my advisors in grad school told me you always have to look at the addresses and look at the maps. And the address is 47th and Ashland Ave. That's the stockyards. And it's 1890s stockyards. That means blood was running down the street. It means there were so many flies, you could not tell what color those houses were painted because they were covered in flies.
Wow.
It is not the place I picture when I think of suburbs. And yet, it's in this classic suburban ad. And so I went back to find Samuel Eberle Gross's marketing book that this ad comes from. And all you have to do is flip the page. And the very next page explains, buy a house in my subdivision and you can go home for lunch. It's not the same commuter suburb we think of. It's live next to your work in the stockyards. And that you, as a working man in the stockyards, must really, really want to own your own home because you want to have something you can control. And that another one of Samuel Eberle Gross's ad lines was, better than a bank for a poor man. Mm-hmm. And before 1930s banking laws, banks failed all the time. So workers in Chicago, they were struggling. They didn't have a lot of extra money. But when they did have extra money, putting it in a bank was a really risky thing to do. Putting it into real estate was safer because it was an investment you could see and touch, and then you can improve it yourself because you're a working class person. You know how to build a veranda or have a garden. You come from a rural background, and so you can use this space to help you navigate big corporate industrial capitalism. You don't have much control over work anymore when you're working in the factories. But here you can control your home, which is a sort of work too.
Yeah.
It's different from the elite version of suburbs, which is home is a break from work.
Right.
But not that different, because even elites want to gain some value from their property. And but instead, it's much more conscious of this is a business too. And you can have a garden, you can take in boarders, you can, in one of Samuel Eberle Gross's ads, he explains, you can open a laundry because your things will dry better out here in the outskirts of town. And then you can make a lot of money in case you lose your job or you need to balance other things in the whole family economy. So suburbs, instead of being this post-war, desperate domestic thing or this conspiracy to control the working class, it turns out workers chose suburbs themselves.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
So they wanted this, but it also turns out you can't fully control your property values. You know, you buy a house in Town of Lake and it might be good for a while, but even as early as 1910s, by the 1920s, the stockyards are slowing down. Meatpacking is moving to Kansas. It's moving further away. And then you're stuck. You have this investment that you thought you could control because you thought you could fix up the attic and make it into a better house. You thought you had this control, but you don't really.
Yeah.
Because there's these bigger forces. There is the huge banking forces, and working class people had trouble getting access to credit then as now. There is these huge economic forces. So if you bought in a factory suburb or an industrial suburb, if that factory closes down, you're much more stranded.
Well, I mean, we see that now. I mean, it's interesting to think about what was the Nabisco factory that closed down in the South Side not too long ago. We see it with auto factories where a lot of people set up shop close by and then that factory leaves and there's despair or we see at least stress on the property values of
yes.
the place. As we wrap up, like the lessons that are learned from your book, I mean, what goes around comes around.
Seems like so what happened
it's
in Chicago
simple, yeah.
is that when people were seeing this thing their family had struggled to own, the property values weren't working the way they wanted to. The easiest person to blame was the African Americans who were just moving in around World War I. It was the early part of the Great Migration. And so African Americans don't actually bear the blame for these property values that you can't control, but it's much easier to attack the blacks
than it is to attack the
banks
right.
or the factory or these great bigger structural forces. So in Chicago, there were two housing-related riots that frame my book. And the first is the one after the Great Chicago Fire when immigrants were fighting for the right to own homes within the city limits.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is the riots of 1919, which have confounded people who study them for a long time because they weren't riots over work. Blacks and whites were working together by 1919 in Chicago, but they were not living together. And they were riots over leisure space and home space. And people were attacked on the streetcars going home from work. And people were killing each other over property values and ideas of property values. And I call this the mortgages of whiteness because there's this whole idea that the working class in America gets divided by race because whites feel a psychological wage that for a long time we've called the wages of whiteness. That you might not be paid that much, but at least you can sit anywhere in the movie theater and at least you can
right.
go to any park. It's this the wages of whiteness. And I think related to that is the mortgages of whiteness, the feeling that you can get on this upwardly moving escalator of property values, that you can hope for this dream that wasn't an immigrant dream but became an American dream of home ownership. And the easiest one to blame when that dream turns to a nightmare, it was the African Americans. And so there was a riot in 1919. It shows how much suburbs aren't just this natural thing. They're not just a homogeneous simple thing. They're not just the way America happens. And some Chicagoans thought it was natural. They said, oh, it's a prairie city. Chicago
mm-hmm.
can extend
mm-hmm.
anywhere. Pretty soon we'll tunnel the lake and annex Canada. They really thought that would
right.
happen, you know? But they're right, though. Chicagoland does extend to Wisconsin and Indiana
right.
now in amazing ways. They said there's no impediments to growth here in Chicago. It's flat everywhere. The only problem is the Canadian border, which is hilarious. But also, people want to live close. People want to live in community. And people built schools and parishes and other things, and they didn't all want to move out. There was a lot of resistance to suburbanization, even as there was this hope of grasping onto the opportunity that suburbanization meant. So that's why Chicago is a fascinating story.
Author Elaine Luenick, her book, The Working Man's Reward, Chicago's Early Suburbs and the Roots of American Sprawl. She is a professor at American Studies at California State University, Fullerton, also a housing historian. Yeah. Elaine, thanks for coming
You're
in.
Welcome.
Thanks for telling us about the history
of
early
suburbs.
I want
to say to Chicagoans, they wrote the textbooks for early realtors, and they invented the real estate lobby.
Right. You got to come back, just so we can talk about the real
Chicago's
estate lobby.
Chicago's amazing.
Yeah. Thanks for being here.
Okay, bye.